Around 5 in the morning, they heard the sound of breaking glass near the imam's office. Then there was an explosion. No one was hurt, but the blast did quite a bit of damage to part of the building immediately around the office.
That's Minnesota Public Radio reporter Matt Sepik describing the moment last summer when a mosque in Minnesota was bombed. 3 Central Illinois men are being accused of the crime. Sepik was at their hearing yesterday and joins us today. Tronks, the name of the company that owns the Chicago Tribune and other newspapers across the country. Their former owner resigned this week, the same day accusations of sexual harassment were leveled against him. And there's more layoffs at the newspaper. Here's NPR's David Folkenflik on Morning Edition.
There's real questions in newsrooms around the country for Tronk about whether decisions are being made in the interest of the journalism and in the interest of the shareholders and in the interest of the audiences.
Also, spring has sprung, which means it's time to think about the plants and greenery that have been lying dormant under all that snow and ice. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last summer, a mosque in Minnesota was bombed. While hate crimes against Muslims have been on the rise throughout the U.S., the reason we're talking about this particular case today is because 3 Central Illinois men have been charged in connection with that bombing. Yesterday, 2 of the 3, Michael Harry and Michael McWhorter, were in an Illinois federal courtroom in Urbana for their preliminary hearing. Minnesota Public Radio reporter Matt Sepik was at that hearing and has been following the case, and he joins us now in our Urbana studios. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
I think many people in Illinois probably aren't familiar with this case, so I think we should start by asking, can you explain what happened last August?
Yes. According to the criminal complaint filed by federal prosecutors in Minnesota, 3 men, 47-year-old Michael Harry, 29-year-old Michael McWhorter, and 22-year-old Joe Morris, drove from the tiny town of Clarence, Illinois, just about a half hour from Champaign-Urbana, and threw a pipe bomb through the window of the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington, Minnesota. That's about 2 miles away from the Mall of America.
So Bloomington, Minnesota, because I was listening to some of your stories and you were saying this was happening in Bloomington, not to be confused with Bloomington,
correct,
Illinois. What happened at yesterday's hearing?
There wasn't a whole lot that happened at the hearing yesterday. Each walked into the courtroom wearing prison jumpsuits and essentially waive their right to a preliminary hearing. The judge asked them if they knew what they were doing, and each of the men said yes and agreed to waive the hearing. This would have been a chance for them to call witnesses and rebut the government's evidence against them at this early stage in the case. But certainly if this goes to trial, they'll have a chance to do that again.
What exactly have they been charged with?
Well, there are 2 separate criminal complaints. There's one here in Urbana related to the attempted bombing of a clinic in Champaign that performs abortions. This happened in November when someone threw a device that did not explode through a window into the building. There's a separate criminal complaint in Minnesota charging them with maliciously damaging the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington, Minnesota, by means of an explosive device. That's the actual charge at this point that they are being held on. A grand jury has the case now. It's been bound over according to court documents, and additional charges could be coming once the grand jury gets a chance to review the evidence that the government has collected.
And are these charges, is this considered domestic, are these considered hate crimes? What are the specific, the FBI is involved with this?
They are absolutely involved in this, and they have been investigating this. Whether hate crime charges will come will be up to federal prosecutors. Right now, they've been charged only by complaint. In order for the case to proceed, they have to be indicted by a grand jury. And certainly, when and if that happens in the coming weeks, we could see more charges.
What do we know about the 2 of the suspects that were in court yesterday, Michael Harry and Michael McWhorter? What do we know about them so far?
Michael Harry has quite a long and colorful history. He's lived in Clarence for a while and in this part of Illinois for quite some time. He's 47 years old. He was married in the 1990s, divorced in 2001. In 2005, he kidnapped his 2 daughters, who were then teenagers. took them to Mexico and then Belize to a German Baptist community. That's a religious group that in a lot of ways is similar to the Amish in some of their theology and certainly in their appearance and manner of dress. Harry's ex-wife, Michelle Frakes of Peoria, was concerned, as certainly as you could understand, that her daughters were missing. Her ex-husband had taken them out of the country. She didn't know where they were. So she called the Dr. Phil TV show. The Dr. Phil show hired a private investigator in from Georgia, a former FBI agent named Harold Kopus. And Kopus actually tracked Harry and his two daughters down by making contacts with the German Baptist community here in Illinois and a man involved in that same community who was living in southern Minnesota at the time. He's able to track Harry and his two daughters to Belize, where he found them living among the German Baptist community there in a sort of commune type of arrangement. And he convinced them to come back to the United States. In 2006, the state's attorney in Ford County charged Harry with kidnapping. A jury there found him guilty, and he was sentenced to 30 months probation for taking his daughters out of the country without their mother's permission.
So you mentioned Minnesota. What is that? Maybe the first Minnesota tie? Do we know why? What have prosecutors said about why they believe these men drove to Minnesota to commit this crime?
They have not said. There was a news conference last week in Minneapolis after the men were arrested and charged in the initial complaint. Prosecutors are very circumspect about what they say, particularly with charging documents. They don't want to jeopardize the case. They essentially stuck to a statement, really didn't take questions about why these guys allegedly went 500 miles from Clarence, Illinois to Bloomington, Minnesota to throw a pipe bomb through the window of an Islamic center. That's what folks at the mosque who I talked to last week are trying to figure out. That's what a lot of people in Minnesota and here in Illinois are trying to figure out. That connection that Harry had in the mid-2000s to the German Baptist community in Minnesota appears to be tenuous. The man who he knew back then, I don't believe, even lives in the United States anymore. So it's really anyone's guess at this point as to why they chose to target this mosque so far away from where they live.
Minnesota Public Radio reporter Matt Sepik is in our neck of the woods as we're discussing this case. Matt, did we hear anything from Michael Harry or Michael McWhorter yesterday?
They only answered yes to the judge when he asked them if they understood their rights in waiving the preliminary hearing. That's it. Family members of Harry and Michael McWhorter were in court basically to see them. They didn't really interact other than McWhorter waving to his mother who was in the gallery.
And did they answer any questions from you afterwards?
They did not. They did not want to comment.
What's the next big date for this case? What are we waiting on now? What's the next step?
Really, what we're waiting for next is whatever the grand jury decides and whether they decide that the government has made its case in bringing charges against these men. And, we could see an indictment here sometime in the next few weeks if the grand jury believes that the evidence that the government has collected is making the case for them.
In the meantime, they're in jail here in Illinois.
They are being held in jail. They are in the custody officially of the United States Marshals Service, and the U.S. Marshal contracts with local jails to house defendants who are awaiting court proceedings and awaiting trials. They are not saying where the men are being held. In fact, they're really going out of their way to conceal that. The jumpsuits that the men wore in jail yesterday did not have any markings that would indicate what jail they're from. You know, usually you see somebody in a jail jumpsuit and it'll say Ford County Jail or Champaign County Jail or something like that. These didn't have any markings on that. And I think they may be at different jails because they were all wearing different style jumpsuits, different colors.
So from what I understand, there's a lot of backstory here, but this isn't the only crime that the three have been charged with. Can you also let us know about other crimes that Michael Harry has been charged with?
Harry is charged in Ford County on a state charge of assault for allegedly attacking one of his neighbors. This is a fellow who lives right next door to property that Harry owns in the town of Clarence. His name is John O'Neill. And I spoke with him and his wife, Hope, the other night at their home in Clarence. And he recounted really an awful situation that he faced back in July. O'Neill went to confront Harry about dogs running loose of Harry's that were getting into O'Neill's garbage and just really kind of making a mess. And Harry did not take this well. He allegedly, and this is according to a criminal complaint in Ford County from the state's attorney there, Harry allegedly held O'Neill at gunpoint in the trunk of Harry's car in early July.
Oh my.
And was threatening him. And O'Neill related later that Harry just couldn't let this go. Harry allegedly planted bombs, and this is recounted in the federal complaint in the Central District of Illinois, in O'Neill's backyard shed. This is an area where his daughters play and a lot of kids in the town play. This was at the end of February. Harry put these bombs and explosive materials in this shed, and then, according to the federal complaint, called in a phony tip to the ATF. That's what led the federal investigators and the FBI and ATF to come out at the end of February with bomb robots, and they retrieved all of this material from O'Neill's shed. Now, O'Neill tells me they never treated him as a suspect. They treated him as a victim this whole time, and it is outlined in the complaint against Harry and the others that he essentially framed O'Neill. And this appears to be retaliation for O'Neill complaining about his dogs. And really what it wound up doing in the end, instead of getting O'Neill into trouble, as it appears that Harry had hoped, it wound up bringing federal investigators to the town of Clarence, where they uncovered this alleged bomb plot.
Matt, is there any indication from the people at the mosque as to what they would like to see happen with this case?
They were quite happy with the news that the men who allegedly attacked their mosque were arrested and are in jail. They certainly said that they want to see justice served here, but they're asking that big question. They want to know why their mosque in particular was targeted and whether these men here in Illinois had any contacts or were encouraged by somebody in Minnesota, perhaps. But we just don't know that. We could find that out once more comes out about the case and any additional charges come.
Lots of questions here. One last question for you, Matt. How is everyone doing at this Islamic center?
Pretty well. It's one of the larger Islamic centers in the Twin Cities, which has a large Muslim population, which is primarily Somali-American. It's a building that is in a former school. The Islamic center staff was really encouraged by the response from the community in Bloomington, Minnesota, that came together. There were solidarity rallies in early August, right after the bombing on August 5th. The local Carpenters Union donated labor and materials to rebuild the imam's office, and it looks all nice and new now that it's been repaired and fixed up following the attack. The bombing did quite a bit of damage inside the room, but it was generally contained to that one room. There wasn't, you know, huge structural damage to the rest of the building. And thankfully, no one was hurt. This happened around 5 a.m. on this day in August. There were a few people there, five people, according to the criminal complaint, who had gathered for early morning prayers, but no one was hurt.
Minnesota Public Radio reporter Matt Sepik. Matt, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Nyla.
Thank you. March Madness is in full swing. 16 teams are left standing in both men's and women's tournaments. On the women's side, the only Illinois team, DePaul, lost in the second round to Texas A&M. And on the men's side, the Ramblers of Loyola Chicago are still in it. They pulled off two stunning last-second upsets, first against Miami and then against Tennessee. Junior Clayton Custer hit a fadeaway jumper that bounced high off the rim and in with just 3 seconds left. Let's have a listen.
Inbound to Custer. Here comes the player of the year. The MVC rises. Oh, getting it! No timeouts for Tennessee. Bone rises. Now! And the dream is alive. Loyola rambling on to the Sweet 16.
That's Pharaoh Dedes on TNT. The Ramblers have been winning the hearts of fans across the nation, not just for their play, but of course for their biggest fan, a 98-year-old nun named Sister Jean. She says a prayer with the team before every game. Here she is on Good Morning America.
At the end of the game, we want to be sure that when the buzzer goes off, that the numbers indicate that we get the big W. I pray for the other team, perhaps not as hard. But that's what people tell me. So we have God on our side, and these young men have great faith. And if you don't have confidence and faith, then you might as well not be playing.
And Sister Jean, if you want to cheer on the Ramblers, they face off against Nevada tonight at 6 on CBS. And by the way, coming up, March is about more than just basketball. We're going to be talking about spring gardening, and we want to answer your questions. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Tweet us at 21STShow. We'll get started just after this break. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. While our neighbors to the east are being clobbered with a winter storm, here in Illinois, we're actually seeing glimpses of actual spring weather now that the season hasn't officially begun. And for many of us, that means a chance to turn our attention to the garden. Every year, lots of people have the same questions. When should you start planting? And how? To help us answer these questions and more, we've got some pros on the line from the Morton Arboretum in Lisle. Doris Taylor is the manager of the Plant Clinic. And from Galesburg, Chris Enroth is a horticulture educator at the University of Illinois Extension. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for asking.
Thank you.
And before we begin, I want to remind our audience, we're happy to take your calls and your Twitter questions. You can call us at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show. Doris, this is a time of year when we're all pretty confused about what season it is, right? I think that's what spring in Illinois often means. If it's right, freezing rain or 60s and sunny. Are plants confused this time of year as well?
Yes and no. I mean, they're on their own cycle, and they really do go by temperature and sunlight and stuff. And so many plants are starting to come out of dormancy, but not quite yet. And last night up in the Chicago area, we had a frost, but nothing that really did any damage. I mean, and we also have things flowering. So, you know, spring is happening.
And Chris, so what should people be doing this time of year? We've got people listening all over the state. What should March be about, whether you're in the northern part of Illinois or southern Illinois?
Well, March for most home gardeners needs to be more looking out kind of at the extended forecast to see when those spring freezes or frosts are going to be coming to hit some of our plants. And this is kind of It's an interesting winter in that in the past couple winters, we've actually been worried that it's been too warm for our plants. And so now we've actually experienced, I think, more of a typical Midwestern winter. And now we're back to that typical Midwestern spring where we really do have to keep an eye on these swings of temperature. And when we do see in that forecast, if temperatures are going to be getting down in the lower 30s, that's a good idea if we have any, say, bulbs that might be emerging, any type of perennials that are coming out of the ground, cover those with some shredded leaves, a small blanket, or any even row cover, something like that. When it comes to our trees and shrubs, though, that becomes a little bit more difficult to protect some of those plants.
So particular, what flowers or plants should we be, you mentioned bulbs, what other flowers or plants should we be careful about in that we really need to baby this time of year?
Well, most of the ones that emerge in the spring, you know, in terms of their evolution, they are adapted to experiencing swings and the warm to cold. And so a lot of times, a lot of our cool season plants, you know, we think of something like pansies, you know, we think of that, well, that must be a very weak and tender type plant. It's probably one of our strongest plants that we have out in the landscape. But if we look at things like tulips or daffodils, it's kind of hard to protect those flowers once they're out of the ground. But again, we cover those up and so that the cold either doesn't harm the flower while it's still in the bud or as it's emerged. And really, that's about all that we can do. It's kind of that the old saying, you know, in this game of gardening, nature bats last. And so we just kind of have to, we're on this ride and we're trying to protect our plants as best as we can.
Pansies are strong. That is what we have just learned from
Chris. That is the key for today. Plant some pansies out there because they're tough.
Okay. If you have questions, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Doris, so it sounds like also our plants are probably more hardy and used to the fluctuating temperatures than we are in a way, right?
Especially our native plants and trees and shrubs. But, you know, like the last few years have just been an undulating up and down, whether it's been cold or, you know, warmer than usual, like Chris was saying. That, but things for us right now are starting to flower, like witch hazels and, you know, our daffodil bulbs are, you know, the leaves are coming up, but not the bulb, you know, the flower bulb yet. So, you know, they're adapting. And for those extremes, like we're going to have a cold temperature at night, that's where you want to take Chris's advice and get out and, you know, cover the stuff on the ground if you can.
Doris, for people who are interested in making sure that their plants are native, or there's particular, if we're thinking about flowers, what are good recommendations for people if they want to make sure they're keeping, or at least part of their garden has native plants?
You know, and again, it's how they've adapted to the area, but, you know, it's really just kind of doing the research on which plants you're selecting. And you know, the Morton Arboretum website, the University of Illinois website, even local nurseries, you know, are really pushing native plants now. So it's, you know, just getting out there and, you know, seeing what's available. And don't be afraid to ask.
Chris, do you have any favorite native plants?
Oh, that's kind of like asking a parent their favorite child.
Yeah, well, you can name it. It's more than, I'm not saying to pick one. You can pick a couple.
But, well, I guess if we look at some of our more early spring type plants, and the thing I always ask too when I have a homeowner or a client, someone asking, oh, I really want some native plants, you know, the first thing you need to analyze is native to where. So where I'm located in west central Illinois, you know, our historic native vegetation was a tall grass prairie. And kind of the unfortunate thing with tall grass prairies is they tend not to be very showy in the early spring months, and so there's not as many plants to choose from. However, there's one that I think really needs called Prairie Smoke, and it's a plant. Mm-hmm. It only grows just kind of, you know, a couple inches tall, but it gets these wispy smoke-like flowers on the top, and when you see them in a mass planting, it's actually pretty cool. It kind of looks like this low fog on the ground right there. But with prairies, they tend to grow up during the growing season. And so right now, you know, just plants are emerging, and then you have low-growing flowering plants, and then they just get taller and taller, as the name Tall Grass Prairie says. And they really come into their own, you know, about mid to late summer is when we see a lot of really pretty shows. So unfortunately for our native stuff, not too much to recommend in terms of the tall grass prairie side of things. Now, for our shrubs, you know, things like viburnums and other, you know, spring flowering shrubs like that, I really like viburnums and dogwoods for the landscape that are native in our area.
And you mentioned for your area, for West Central Illinois, but prairie grass is, correct me if I'm wrong, are there just different kinds of prairie grass in the northern and southern parts of the state, Chris?
Yeah, so you'll find different types of prairie grasses. And so, you know, one example is we have a prairie grass called prairie drop seed. And you also have a cousin to that called northern drop seed. And so it kind of depends. Yes, so different species have developed in different parts of Illinois. They are related, but however, some of them look fairly different. Some very tall bunch growers, some kind of more spreading, low-growing type grasses. So it kind of depends on where you're located, but most landscape nurseries are going to be selling things like switchgrass, big blue stem, and little blue stem.
And those are native or those not?
Those are native. Yes.
They are. Okay. Chris, what's your recommendation for folks who are interested in doing prairie grasses but maybe are concerned about maintenance or how tall they are, or just kind of, I've seen some yards where people think they look messy. That's kind of sometimes a controversial statement when you're talking about prairie grass and people who want their yards to look natural. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I guess I have to kind of speak from like where I would stand. You know, I live in a neighborhood. We have an HOA, and so you kind of have to get all of that stuff approved by an HOA or make sure that you're following local city codes on the types of plantings available, because most prairie grasses, you're correct, you know, they can get kind of this bad reputation of being like a weedy mess. And so I would just say make sure that you devote ample space in your yard if you want to do some type of a prairie grass or just like a prairie planting. You know, don't try to go overboard also at the same time. Don't try to include 1,000 different species in that planting. You know, start simple. Maybe you'll start something with like a little blue stem and then seed in some type of black-eyed Susan. And you can add plants as you go on. In terms of that, so I would say, yep, give it plenty of room. Make sure you're okay to put something like that into your yard, and then just be prepared, because it does take time for native plants to establish themselves, because they work a lot of their energy in the beginning on their root system and less on the vegetative and flowering side of things.
How long then, Chris?
Usually for folks that are installing some type of prairie garden or pollinator garden, rain garden, we say give it at least 2 years, and so in that 2 year time, that root system is developing on those native perennial plants, but we have a lot of annual weeds that might be germinating too. So in that 2 year time frame, stay on top of that weed control, use mulch. You can hoe things out of the soil there, cultivate the soil, but really make sure you keep those weeds down that first couple years.
That's Chris Enroth. He's a horticulture educator with University of Illinois Extension, on the line with us from Galesburg. Doris Taylor is with us as well. She's the manager of the plant clinic at the Morton Arboretum in Lisle. We're taking your questions about gardening. If you want to give us a call, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Doris, what about maybe beginning gardeners? Maybe someone who has never done anything with gardening and they think this spring is the time they're going to start. What's your advice to someone?
I agree with Chris. You want to start small. I mean, you don't want to do your whole yard at one time, because you're going to find the weeds will take over quicker than your plants will get established. But and usually we like to say, you know, pick some good focal points in the yard. I mean, are you looking out a kitchen window? Are you sitting by your patio? Maybe start with just some small beds around there. And again, you need to know your site conditions. You know, does a downspout head that way, that it's more wet, or is this a nice sunny area, or maybe just morning shade? So, you know, there's a whole range of different plants, and you can, you know, incorporate in grasses, perennials, you know, ground covers. Definitely, you know, start with your trees and shrubs, you know, first, because they're going to be your focal point and the bigger plant in the landscape. And then work your way around that. So usually start small is the best thing. But don't be afraid to try a plant that you really like.
Chris, what about weeds? What about people who are worried about their kids and their pets and different things in terms of pesticides or other things to spray?
Well, that's a really good question and one that we get a lot at the Extension office. And, you know, a weed is just a plant that's out of place. So, for instance, in my yard, I have three young boys. I mean, what would summer be like without picking dandelions, you know? And so it kind of depends on the person. But if someone's worried about spraying herbicides on their lawns to control weeds, and it's just basically that question they have to ask themselves. Is killing those dandelions or that clover, is that worth it to them? And so you just have to make sure you're accounting for, you know, what your goals are for your yard. If you need to have that perfectly immaculate lawn that just like glows in the dark at nighttime and is the talk of the neighborhood, then yeah, you'll probably be spraying some type of pesticide or herbicide. But the key thing is when using those products is to read the label. That label is the key to protecting you, your family, your neighbors, and the environment. So read the label and follow those directions.
We got a couple of callers. I want to make sure we get to them. Let's start with Lori in Rockford. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the 21st. What's your question?
Hi. We have a little, I think it's an oak tree that has grown up in one of our berms in our yard, and my husband wants to move it, and we wondered if this time of year is okay to do it or if it could damage it and we should maybe wait till next fall.
Doris, you want to tackle that one?
Sure. You know what? It's about how tall are we talking? I mean, it's just a little seedling that's come up?
Well, it's bigger than that now. I would say okay. It's about probably between five and 6 feet now.
Oh, so, I mean, it's been there a while then. You know what?
Yeah.
Keeping it while it's dormant is a good idea as long as your soil is workable. You don't want to, you know, dig a hole and have it be mucky and met, you know, because you'll change the soil structure. But ideally, you know, digging a big enough hole, you need to probably be at least a foot out from the trunk all the way around. So, you know, the bigger you're doing that, the more it's better. Now, oaks do have a taproot. I mean, eventually it loses that taproot. So you will probably have to dig a trench on that 12-inch, area, which we're talking now 24 inches across, and dig down about 18 inches or so till you're starting to find roots. But the sooner you do it while it's dormant before leaves come out, you know, the more established it will be. And you just definitely have to water it and put a good mulch ring around it.
Thanks for that. Let's
but
try
you're,
to.
You're getting up there.
Yeah, that sounds like a big one. Let's try to go to Joe from Springfield. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the 21st. What's your question?
Howdy. Well, I've got three peach trees. They're about 3, 4, and 5 years old. I planted them a couple of years ago, and I've just wondered. I've never pruned them, but when should I prune them? And have you got any tips?
Chris, you want to tackle that one?
Oh, sure. So, Joe, best time for pruning these things is while they are dormant. And so right now, so after you get off the phone, you know, get those pruners sharpened and cleaned off and get out there and start cutting away. Peach trees can actually tolerate a fairly heavy pruning. Now, for most woody plants, we do say, you know, avoid removing more than like a quarter to a third of mass of that plant at any one time. Same holds true for peaches. And so if you've never pruned them, you're basically at this young age for the 3 or 4 year old plants, you're just pruning them for that basic structure for the long term. And the way I've seen peaches pruned in like a commercial orchard or on campus, these folks, they're pruning them kind of in a style of like a wagon wheel. You know, you have this central stem or trunk in the middle, and then you have these branches radiating off at different directions off of that central stem. And kind of depends also on the type of peaches. Do you know, are they dwarf peaches, semi-dwarf, or kind of the old-fashioned kind?
Well, I really don't know. My brother sprouted them from seeds that we had in my parents' house, and he had about 20 of them, and I just got a couple of them.
Okay, so peaches grown from seed, I would just assume that they're going to be they have the potential to become large monsters. And so,
and unfortunately, Chris, thanks for that. We're almost out of time, but it sounds like you're saying you can prune it pretty aggressively. Does that sound
pretty aggressively right now?
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Joe, for that. Thanks to our callers. I want to thank Chris Enroth with U of I Extension and Doris Taylor with the Morton Arboretum. Thanks for being with me, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you
very much.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Studies MillerCom 18 Lecture Series, presenting Toward a Manifesto for Diverse Psychological Science, March 26th to 4 p.m. at Beckman Institute. Professor of Psychology Enrique Niblett will discuss incorporating diversity and the human experience into psychological science. cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you open up your local newspaper, whether it's online or the old-fashioned way, you probably don't see the name of the company that owns it. Maybe you know owners like Jeff Bezos from Amazon, who owns the Washington Post. But one name you may have heard of or not is called Tronc, short for Tribune Online Content. Tronc is a huge company that owns the Chicago Tribune, along with the New York Daily News, the Baltimore Sun, and other papers across the nation. Until recently, they also own the LA Times. Last week has been a turbulent one that infected the entire newsroom at the Chicago Tribune. There was a new round of layoffs last week, and on Monday, Michael Farrow, Tronc's chairman and biggest shareholder, resigned. The same day, accusations of sexual misconduct surfaced about him. What's going on behind the scenes and how does this affect you? NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has been reporting on this, and he joins us from NPR's New York office. Hi, David. Welcome to The 21st.
Hey, delighted to join you.
David, before we get to this whole new round of layoffs and Michael Farrow's resignation, what can you tell us about Tronc? I mean, other than the name, which lots of journalists in Illinois have been making fun of for a while, can you tell us what kind of company it is and how it compares to other large companies that own newspapers across the country?
Sure. And I wouldn't say that journalists in Illinois are alone in making fun of the name Tronc. Tronc is sort of the remnant of the newspaper side of what was the old Tribune Company. It owned a bunch of television stations around the country as well. They're now part of a company called Tribune Media. And they're in the process of being sold to Sinclair Broadcast Group based outside Baltimore. And that deal is being reviewed with some skepticism down by antitrust officials down in Washington at the federal government. Tronc itself, you know, Tribune, you know, this was a proud newspaper chain. It acquired its flagship was the Chicago Tribune, not so many miles from where you guys are. But it acquired around the turn of the millennium what had been called Times Mirror. So it acquired some really great, proud newspapers as well. The Los Angeles Times, my old newspaper, the Baltimore Sun. At that time, it included Newsday, no longer part of the chain. The Hartford Current, the Allentown Morning Call, some really good metro papers around the country. So it's not as big as Gannett, which owns well over 100 papers. It's not as big as what is called Digital First Media, which owns a ton of papers, Gatehouse. There are a lot of bigger newspaper chains around in terms of how many people are reached and particularly how many titles are held. But these are large, proud metro dailies that have helped in some ways to set the news agenda for markets outside of New York and Washington in particular, and in some ways at times forcing the federal government to act. I mean, the LA Times, the Baltimore Sun, as well as the Chicago Tribune in particular, have had proud traditions not only locally and in covering state governments, holding those accountable, but in having really muscular coverage of Washington and foreign coverage as well. And a lot of that has withered in recent years.
A lot of that's withered in recent years. Certainly the Tribune, in terms of their reach and their Washington bureau, in terms of their international bureaus, and folks who are visitors to downtown Chicago can look outside the Tribune building and see the rather bizarre but assortment of collections of items from all over the world that Tribune reporters or executives at times brought back to Chicago. That said, as you're talking about the amount of them, these jobs going away, as I mentioned, there was a new round of layoffs last week, and there wasn't a lot of information. What do we know about how many of these jobs there were that were lost and what kinds of jobs in particular?
You know, the thing was about these layoffs, which is that it wasn't a huge mass layoff. You know, there have been reports that there were plans to do much greater layoffs, for example, at the Los Angeles Times before the announcement that the Times and its sister California paper, the San Diego Union-Tribune, would be sold to the number two shareholder at Tronc, who's a billionaire doctor who lives in Southern California. The size of the layoffs at the Chicago Tribune weren't that big, but they were significant. They involved people like a senior photo and design editor, Their sole Washington, D.C. reporter for the Chicago Tribune. I remember when that bureau had people in double digits. They laid off a very noted education reporter there in Chicago. They laid off copy editors, a sports beat reporter. People who are seen, one longtime journalist there said, you know, they're not cutting meat, they're cutting bone. And the real issue was that there was very little conveyed about the scope of this publicly, that this followed on the heels of layoffs last October, if I remember correctly, at the Tribune. And there was no word that this would be it. It's just that this is what's happening now. And the additional thing was that reporters basically were forced to go into their bosses and effectively reapply for their old jobs. And as the at least articulated philosophy and desire of these reconstruction and reconfiguration of the newsroom is to flatten the newsroom. It's to compress it. It's to get rid of certain layers of copy editing and certain layers of editors, have more reporters on the street, at least as it's described publicly. You're seeing editors and others, it seems, according to staffers I've talked to, pushed into the competition for those beats being covered. Now, I'm not saying that even more people will be laid off, although I think that's probably likely along the way. It's that even in the moment, people don't know what assignments they're going to have, whether or not these are jobs they want to have or what's being done. And I think that's extremely unsettling for a newsroom that supposedly values transparency in the agencies and government bodies, corporate figures that it covers, not having any kind of transparency itself as to what the heck's happening, where their futures lie.
I think there are probably people listening, David, who've heard lots of stories. They've heard your reporting on NPR about media for years. They know that they feel like newspapers are a business model that's really tough. But I think they people might be wondering what the impact will be on them. We've been talking about money and jobs. What kind of impact do you think this will have on content?
You know, I think that there's a assuming Tronc still exists a couple years from now, and I have my doubts as to my belief that the news of the last week or two or three will suggest that ultimately the owners of Tronc will try to sell themselves off. But let's say it still sticks around. They have an articulated digital strategy, which is called Gravitas with Scale. It's from their chief digital officer, a guy named Ross Levinson, who for some months was the publisher of the LA Times and was went on leave after we at NPR raised some questions about past issues that had been raised about his workplace conduct. And he had been named as one defendant in two separate lawsuits later settled that alleged sexual harassment and workplace issues. So let's put that to the side. The philosophy that they've articulated this Gravitas with Scale. The idea is that they will build up this newsroom for the Tronc chain outside of the newsrooms for the newspapers themselves that will develop content that is of interest to readers digitally. And they will essentially stuff this under the brands that have been built over the decades, over in many cases more than a century, in all these different markets across the country, in South Florida, in Central Connecticut, in New York, in Baltimore, and so on. And that they think, well, if we just push all this additional content, well, part of the question is, what kind of content are we talking about? Are we talking about journalism? Are we talking about things that are consistent with the brands of the Baltimore Sun, the Chicago Tribune, and others? Are we talking about partnering with organizations that will fulfill not only the desires of what people want to click on, but their need to understand the worlds around them? And so you're seeing a building up of this. I'm not saying it's all going to be clickbait. I'm not saying it's all going to be cat lists. I'm not saying it's all going to be entertainment. But we really don't fully know. What we do know is that they want to build partnerships with figures outside of their own company, and they want to create essentially content producers. It's a different definition than journalism, and it's a different imperative, and they want to trade on the brand equity of these newspapers that even diminished by a crippling lack of resources and a constriction of ambition, I think have fought very hard in most cases to do their best to fulfill a journalistic mandate while trying to meet the needs, the financial dictates of their corporate ownerships.
My guest is NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik. We're talking about the former Tribune Company, now Tronc. And David, as we look at newspaper owners and LA Times and all my friends in the newspaper world seemed very happy about who ended up buying the LA Times. What's best case scenario for people investing before we get to how Michael Farrow, who just resigned, handled the Tribune Company? What do you see as in terms of people who are best case scenario for people putting journalism first, I would say, in terms of buying newspapers these days? Are there people like that out there?
Well, if you look at Minneapolis, if you look at Boston, where the investor John Henry acquired the Globe 7 years ago from the New York Times Company, if you look at Jeff Bezos, who personally acquired the Washington Post, he's the founder of Amazon, but Amazon itself does not own the Post. You know, those are situations in which exceptionally wealthy entrepreneurs and investors, people with real money, have taken over their hometown papers, are trying to invest in it, you know, are trying to lead these papers towards profitability. And John Henry certainly has overseen significant cuts at the Globe, but people there by and large feel that he is trying to sustain it as a civic good nonetheless. I think that is the best case. On the other hand, I think there's also just a wish fulfillment for somebody to, you know, fly in with an S on a chest and say, you know, I'm going to solve all your problems with a ton of money and I'm going to ride it out. And certainly billionaires can do that. But even Jeff Bezos, for whom the Washington Post, the acquisition of, I think, about $250 million was a bit like my spending money on a stamp. Even he has pushed this paper and prodded it to think very carefully about metrics and ways in which it can push itself towards profitability and reach that goal, even as it fulfills its value. That said, let's take one moment and look at Tribune and Tronc. This is a company that is hit hard by the same issues that have hit newspapers all over the country, large and small, the diminution of classified advertising and advertising, people reading things for free online. All those issues are there. But this was also a company loaded by billions of dollars of debt a little over a decade ago, and that kind of shattered it in some ways. And you've seen this new, you know, that was under Sam Zell. You've seen investment firms that do not have any sense of a journalistic imperative or value, even as they seek profits. You've seen Michael Farrow extract money. You know, the corporate leadership of Tronc is really, to my mind, covering the industry for about 18 years now, it's very highly paid given the financial troubles it's in. You know, just a few days ago, their top executives told investors, we can't give you an economic forecast because we don't know what we're going to say. Well, that's extremely unsettling for investors. I think in part that's related to the fact they sold off their largest property in the LA Times, but that's a big deal. Michael Farrow is the largest individual shareholder, the controlling owner of this publicly traded company. He was chairman until a few days ago, and yet he has given himself, or the company has given him, a $5 million a year consulting fee. It's not clear to me exactly what value that he's providing beyond what one would expect from a controlling owner. Major other officials, Ross Levinson, their new chief digital officer over this division called Tribune Interactive, receives a package that one expert assessed to me as over $4 million a year.
So, David,
major compensations. So the question I just would say is, in whose interest this company is being run, the shareholders, the employees, the journalists, or the executives?
We just have 2 minutes left, but I want to ask you just very quickly about Michael Farrow. The sexual harassment allegations that were brought against him on Monday, Fortune magazine published a pretty detailed piece with two women on the record describing highly inappropriate behavior. What's Tronc saying about all of that now?
He stepped down a few hours ahead of the sheriff, the law on this one, the publication of this by Fortune. I do think it was very well detailed, and I think the fact that two women offered their accounts by name made it all the more powerful and credible in some ways. Tronc is treating it as though he's some sort of private citizen, and therefore it doesn't have to in any way respond to these allegations other than to say that there were no formal lawsuits against him and a couple details like that.
Even though he's still going to make that $5 million a year.
And he's still the controlling owner.
Last question for you. There are people, David, who might be listening thinking, I don't care about newspapers. They're gone or they're dying. Although I must say, as someone who got their start at the Miami Herald, it hurts my heart a little bit to say that. Why do you think newspapers matter?
I think it matters, if there's a disaster in your area, if there's a public health alert, if there's questions of the quality of schools, if there's questions of who's doing things in your community about which you're unaware that affects your life, newspapers and newsrooms more generally are the best ways you're likely to have these things brought to light and that you're able to do about it. These are entities that at their best or even in their off days are going to try to inform us as citizens rather than merely as consumers.
So the people who are listening, who are hearing this, who have been following your reporters and maybe are longtime subscribers to the Tribune, and they're wondering what they can do. We know that public radio listeners do support good journalism. What would you say to them?
I would say support public radio. I would say subscribe to the newspapers that you value. I would say make sure that you sample a variety of different sources of information. And I would say, you know, demand – this is a nonpartisan value. Demand transparency from your law elected officials, from major corporate and private entities in your area, from journalistic organizations themselves. You know, insist on those values and support those news organizations that are trying to represent you and serve you in that light.
NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa and NPR One, you can also play us there. If you have NPR One enabled, you can just say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of the links to find us, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us is all at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Fatima Farhar is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.